in your VCR at home, if you're interested in getting the sign-up sheet out there, please take advantage of it. And we're proposing to Matt and Lawrence into Harlem. I've been masters now in the hospital, so I'm coming back in. Now, I'm trying to even remember what the given title of this panel was. It was the Soviet study. It's really the future of barbecue, looking at some of the issues that affect where we're going, some of the kinds of changes that are taking place in the day of how we all grew up on barbecue in the restaurant we do in the old days, knows that we are going now. Additionally, we have someone from the competition circuit to talk specifically about that aspect of what's going on. But I'd like to introduce our panelists one at a time, have them talk about their lives, their businesses, and their involvement in barbecue, and then open up a panel discussion when I ask questions posed to each of them. The first person that I would like to invite to speak is Van Sykes of Bob Sykes Barbecue. And his story is an interesting one. It's a transition very much from the old tradition to the new stuff. He was a quote that he gave John T. about his father. His father started the barbecue business and ultimately grew into a 14-chain operation. Van, speaking of his father, he wanted to get it right, to serve something he was proud of. He grew up in a little farming community near Cumberland City, Tennessee, near Clarksville. Back when there was still whole hog killers on cold winter days, and there was this local black man that everybody knew by the name of Buck Hampton. Mr. Hampton would travel from farm to farm, building a pit and smoking meat for people. He was kind of a pit master for hire. I think my daddy was trying to recreate the taste from his past when he started out. Years later, I can remember him riding with my daddy back home to look for Mr. Hampton. He was an old silver-haired guy. Daddy told him how he was cooking the meat, and what he was doing, Mr. Hampton told him about a few adjustments that he made. Van Sykes is now in the process of not only running his restaurant, but trying to open some others, trying to do some franchising. So I'd like him to talk about his business based in Destin, Alabama. Mr. Van Sykes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. First of all, I'm very proud to say that I am a second-generation pit master. I've grown up in it all my life. It's really all I've ever done other than a little stint in the military. I was figuring the other day, just in my, I've been running the store like 27 years. During that time, I've estimated I've probably cooked about 6.5 million pounds of barbecue pork. We do about 800 to 1,000 pounds a day, 6 days a week, and it's very consistent. Got a loyal following. You know, I've got that type of customer that'll stand up and you know, talk to you pretty rough about how much they like Bob Sykes Barbecue. So that makes you feel good when you hear that. My dad was one of those people that had just an excellent palate. And growing up, I remember him going around and we tried everybody else's barbecue sauce, and a lot of people didn't want to give it to us, but he'd ask for a little bit in a coffee cup, and we'd get outside and pour it in a napkin, and he would start his analysis, and after a few years, he came up with a concoction of his own that is pretty good, and it's designed to bring out the hickory cooking that we do instead of like overpowering. It's really a sauce that's just designed to bring out the flavor of the hickory. It works really good, and you know, he was just had one of those excellent palates, and he was just able to develop that. Now the issues that I've tried to face is to sell barbecue today. I mean, you got to fit people's lifestyle. And we live in a fast world. And for that restaurant to succeed on into the new millennium or the next generation, what I've had to try to do is, I've got computers we take orders on. We run a pretty efficient, quick drive-through. We got a self-service drink machine. But before you throw anything at me, for all the purists out there, that's from the counter to the front door. Well, from the counter to the back door, that's the same restaurant it was in 1957. There's no microwave then. There's no microwave now. It's the same kitchen. It's amazing when I look back at the photos of the old place, you know. I mean, it still looks the same, you know, because we do things the same way. But, you know, to survive, if you can't fit somebody's lifestyle, they may like your food, but they can't eat with you. You know, so what I've tried to do is modernize from the counter forward, but from the counter to the back of, you know, back of the house to the back door, it's the same operation it's always been. We start, you know, every morning with our hickory. We cure out the fire for a couple of hours. We salt our meat down several hours ahead, and we throw it up there and we cook it. And, you know, everybody wants it to be some incredible, complicated process, but the thing about it is the big ingredient, the big secret ingredient is time. And that's where, you know, you get into trouble, because you've got to, up front, you've got to be fast, and you got to be quick, and you got to take orders, and I got 30 minutes for lunch, and I got to go back to work. But when you get to the back, you got to go back to 1957, and you got to slow it all back down. And then trying to make those two things come together, I think, has been the biggest challenge for me. And I think, you know, we've done it pretty well up to this point.
Our panel consists of three restaurateurs and one person who runs what I think is the largest barbecue society, barbecue competition sanctioning organization in the country, Carolyn Welsh from the Kansas City Barbecue Society. And John Chuck Reed handed out a map of places where the members of the Barbecue Industry Association are located. My guess is that if you looked at a map of places where they hold barbecue competition, sanctioned by one of the three major sanctioning organizations, it'd probably be a broad range of places and locations. So I'd like Carolyn Wells to talk to us in part about what the Kansas City Barbecue Society is about, and more broadly about the competitions and the competition circuit. Okay. Carolyn Wells.
Thanks, Lois. I haven't cooked 6 million pounds of barbecue, but I've tried to eat that much. I am a lifelong student of barbecue. I apologize to those of you who've been around me a lot. You have to endure my piece of useless trivia before I go on. Barbecue is the only food group that has a society, two trade organizations, three trade shows and expos, 9 contest cooking circuits, 8 newspapers, 2 newsletters, 8 newsletters, 2 newspapers, and 3 magazines. You really don't get that with spaghetti. It goes to show what barbecue can do. The Kansas City Barbecue Society is the world's largest organization of barbecue and grilling enthusiasts. We used to be just a barbecue society. Now we're a barbecue and grilling society. We do know the difference. We have 5,000 members. We do know that barbecue is slow and low. Grilling is hot and fast. Both are honorable cooking methods. But in barbecue contests, we do just what it says, barbecue. Competition barbecue is a sport that's been around for about 20 years. We've heard a lot today about Memphis in May. Now, I'm a daughter of the South. I've been to Memphis in May every year but one since 1980, and my feelings were about to get hurt because nobody mentioned Kansas City barbecue. Memphis in May is a sanctioning organization that does 30 to 40 contests a year. There's another sanctioning organization in Texas called IBCA, which is the International Barbecue Cookers Association. They do about 80 contests a year. The Kansas City Barbecue Society does 115 contests every year, coast to coast, and we're growing at about 20% a year. I can only speak, I can't speak for the other ones, but I'm only going to speak about KCBS because it's my organization. Memphis in May. Memphis is the undisputed pork barbecue capital of the world. Memphis in May is not the largest barbecue contest in the world. It is probably the largest pork barbecue contest in the world. The American Royal Barbecue Contest, which is a contest in Kansas City, the first weekend in October, supports the American Royal Association, which is a very large horse and livestock association with a 103-year-old competition. And the barbecue is the largest fundraiser. We have an invitational contest, an open contest, which hosted 391 teams cooking five categories in one day, a 200 contestant side dish contest in three categories, dessert contest, an international barbecue sauce contest presided over by Artie Davis over there, who's the curator of the sauces, a bone art critique contest where you make artwork out of old barbecue bones, including Mona Lisa, Napoleon Bonaparte, Bonehenge. So all a little off-center, a lot of fun. And this year, I'm quite pleased to say, in the open contest, the 391 teams, it was the top three winners were Oklahoma, Alabama. What was the third, Artie? Forgot. Anyway, all the money went out of state. It shows that Southern guys can come to Missouri and cook great and go home with the money, as well as Midwesterners. Oh, Texas was the other one. So. From time to time, it gets all spread around. It's just people who know how to cook great barbecue. This event is the Kansas City Barbecue Society assists these 115 organizations in putting on barbecue events across the country. They are civic and charitable organizations. They do this as a fundraiser to make money for a specific charity or for a community awareness event. My bellwether is for the Royal. We net somewhere around $218,000 every year for the association. Mega volunteers, 24 years coming, but it still holds. The main thing that this whole advent of barbecue competitions is added is a lot of visibility to the barbecue scene. I hope you'll take the opportunity to watch the tape that I brought. It's one that that CBS Sunday Morning did during the baseball strike in 1994, but the information still is very current. It gives you an idea of how ridiculous and colorful these events are. Got lots of colorful characters with lots of funny names, but they're all foodies and they're all really dedicated to their cooking, the ones that aren't dedicated to their partying. And some can do both pretty well at the same time. So this is a way that people get to be kids again. They get to perfect their techniques. It's their bass boat, their golf game, their country club. The camaraderie is great. The food is great. And there's just plenty of worse places to be. So welcome to Competition Barbecue.
Didn't have enough for everyone. If you have some left over, you want to request them, or there should be some near you on the table, you can take a look at it. I'm confident that everybody here has been to a barbecue restaurant before and has a sense of how that works. Competition may not be as well known, so I want to put another minute or two for Carolyn. Tell me what happened if me and a group of friends decided we wanted to compete. How did we do it? Who did we talk to? What happened over there?
Well, what I would recommend is hooking up with a barbecue team and being a lackey for them for a few days to learn to go through the ropes, find out they will let you do all the dirty work. And that's really the best way to learn. You think of it as going on a field trip. You pack up your beverages, you go shopping, you assemble your spices, order your meats. In our competitions, we require four categories. Those are chicken, pork ribs, brisket, and pork butt or shoulder. An organizer can add as many categories as they like onto that, but those are four required for Grand Champion. So you do all your shopping, you just think of it as going camping, pack up the folks, invite your friends over, set up on Friday, party Friday night, long about midnight, it gets a little bit more serious, and you start trimming the meat, seasoning them, getting ready for the competition on Saturday. And then in our system, you are judged every 30 minutes. So everybody's got the same 30 minutes. Everything is judged by 6 judges. And it's really a great system. It works like clockwork, and it would have to do 400 teams in 6 hours and in that many categories. So all blind judging, yes. As opposed to Memphis in May, which is half on-site, half blind. The other thing I might add about our system is that we have a judges certification program where we don't tell you how to judge. I don't tell you the Carolyn Wells theory of barbecue, but you are judging barbecue on its own merit, and it's your opinion that we want, not a group opinion from your table. The computer will take care of that. So you're judging each item on its own merit, from 9 being hypothetically perfect to 1 being a disqualification in 4 categories, in 3 criteria, appearance, tenderness, and then taste. The computer, if they're all, the scores are weighted with taste roughly being double. The computer tabulates it all, drops a low score. The one that spits out is the grand champion or the winner of the category. And then you get to pack up, go home, and wash pans in the backyard on Sunday.
One thing I want to clarify. If you decide you want to have a barbecue competition, you call Kansas City Barbecue Society, IBCA in Texas, or Memphis in May. And in essence, they tell you all the rules and procedures that you can go by. You pick whichever organization's rules you want to use for your own, or some guideline for perhaps writing your own rules for a specific competition. I want to move on now to Frank Verner. And he has an interesting history, in some ways not unlike Van Sykes. When I first went to Memphis to start trying to taste barbecue, we were talking about the legendary old places, one of which was Brady and Lil's. Frank Verner had spent time working for UPS, doing other things, decided to go into the barbecue business, bought Brady and Lil's. 14 years ago?
Yes.
And since then, through a combination of things he learned from them and ingenuity of his own, he's kept that place alive and neat, and it's thriving now. The name has changed. It's now the Barbecue Shop, Memphis, Tennessee. Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Verner.
Okay, this is the first for me. But anyway, my name is Frank Verner. I own the Barbecue Shop. I started out with Brady Liz about 22 years ago. He was a very, very good teacher and an inspiration. He really inspired me. But what I really want to talk about is it starts early in the morning, ends late at night. He taught me from morning to evening on basting, cooking, and doing it the old-fashioned way. He cooked with charcoal, hickory, and it was a long process. It was different because I mostly cooked in the backyard. I'm a backyard cooker just like everybody else. But the whole thing is that doing it the old traditional way, and that's the way I still do it. And that's just point blank. Thanks.
Our final panelist is Rick Oswald. One thing that has interested me in terms of development of barbecue is the extent to which we've gone from people who open restaurants largely because they have a background in barbecue in the backyard and so forth and decide to do it because they want to share their secrets with the world, and people who are investing in barbecue restaurants as the choice they make among several options. Rick's background is a Ford Motor Company, but he is a franchisee with Red, Hot, and Blue. It's based in Jackson, Mississippi. But anyway, I'd like for Rick to talk about his experience with Red, Hot, and Blue with the barbecue franchise and changing that direction of business.
Okay. My story is a little bit different from everybody else's because I approach this from a business standpoint. I'm one of those guys who just love to eat in restaurants and And I always wanted to own a restaurant like most people do, and I realized quite early there was one obstacle to owning a restaurant, and I couldn't cook a lick, and this was going to be a problem. So I went to, Liz and I, my wife walked into a Red Hot Blue in Owings Mills, Maryland about 5 years ago, and we basically fell in love with the food. Of course, that wasn't a first. I've fallen in love with a lot of food over the years, as you can tell, but I thought that it was a great opportunity to take something that I really liked and take it outside of the traditional areas of the country where it's so popular. I also wanted to get back to Mississippi, so I took an early retirement from Ford Credit, and I went to see Bob Friedman, the president of Red Hot Blue, and he said to me very simply, "Let me save you about $500,000. Go home. You don't want any part of this." I didn't listen to him, so I went home to Mississippi. I ended up buying two Red Hot Blues, one that was open and one that had been closed for about a year. And I've been at it for about a year now. The restaurant business is everything that everybody said it was. It's long hours, 18, 20-hour days, and a great opportunity for me to write a book just about the first year in business. So it's been real interesting, and hopefully I can give you a little bit of my experience so far.
Thank you. Gotta interrupt for a housekeeping detail. Anyone who does not have a dessert, please raise your hand. Our volunteers, you see these folks? Are there any volunteers left in the room? Okay. One thing we have not really talked about this weekend is technique and barbecue. In addition to all the sociological stuff that Mandra's folks, I know we got a lot of cooks here. I'd like for each of you to take a couple of minutes to talk about the technique in your establishment and or the kind of things you do in the backyard that might be most useful to folks here who are not going to have a big pit and so forth. You talk about those techniques, including the kind of fuel you use, wood, charcoal, the kind of wood. Whether that use a rub in advance or use some other kind of seasoning technique, and what kind of cooking you use. So what's going on?
Okay. What I always like to tell people is when you come to the store and you're eating barbecue and it's on the plate in front of you, it started perhaps a couple of days before it got there. And somebody had to get the wood and cut it, split it, dry it out a little bit, bring it to me, and the next step I got to do is I've got to take that wood and I got to start a fire. And I like a natural fire. I don't like no fuel, I don't like no gas. I just like a natural burning fire. And, you know, the way I do it is, you know, we take a little loose paper and take a little, perhaps a little denser paper, and then we hat what I call crosshatch the wood so that when this paper burns out, and hickory is very heavy wood, when it burns out, it falls. And when it falls, if you don't stack it up right, it'll smother itself out. That's probably the hardest thing to get somebody learning to make the fire, which is a different process than just keeping it going. But that's the hardest thing for them to understand is the way you have to arrange that wood so that when that paper goes out of there, the wood will have air pockets in it and it'll continue to burn. So then that's the next step. And then you have to, I cook a picnic, and for those that don't know what that is, that when you have a shoulder, you've got a Boston butt on one end and a picnic on the other. I prefer a picnic. I like the skin. I like the the picnic has a bigger bone in it. And I like the flavor of picnic better, so I cook a picnic. I guess, a whole other thing we could go into. I mean, I'm cooking a different animal than my daddy cooked. I mean, the hog is not the same person, fellow, or whatever creature it was 30 years ago. So my dad took shoulders. The shoulders are just enormous now, and I find that they're takes a little too long to get them done because you are running a business. You know, to keep barbecue going, you've always got to address the fact that you're running, you know, you are running a business. You got to sell it, you got to make profit, you got to make payroll and so forth. And, you know, the barbecue in part is wonderful, but you do have to come out with something on the bottom line. But anyway, then I prepared the picnics with some salt, just very simple old thing. But the thing that I've come to realize the last few years is what an incredible effect salt has with fire and smoke. And it's just the reaction that you get from that salt that's set on that meat. It's just, it's a wonderful taste. And I think that's a big part of it is getting that salt on there the right way and letting it sit. And then, you know, once the fire is cured out and all the paper is gone and you're left with just hickory coals, then you put the meat up there, and that's where the thyme thing comes in. And then there's a whole issue of keeping that fire going too. You know, you can't turn a knob. You can't set a temperature gauge the way I do it. I mean, you just have to literally have a feel for it. And that pit can be different today. If it's raining outside and it's cloudy and it's humid, it burns different than it does on a day when the sun's out and the humidity. And it just takes a lot of time, you know, to figure out how to keep that fire. That, you know, the term I've heard around from, you know, I think John Edgerton was a cool fire, which I think that's a wonderful description. A cool fire is really what you're after. So then it's just a matter of knowing when it's done. And after years and years, the best way, people ask me how do I tell when it's done, I just pick it up with a fork. I can tell by the weight. You can stick it with a thermometer. There's, you know, 165 or you know, it's hard to keep them from going to 170, 75 when you got a hot fire. But, you know, that's it. Then you take it off, and the picnic cuts real well. You can get sliced or chopped meat out of the picnic. And I thoroughly spoil my customers. They like it inside, outside, chopped, sliced, and every combination thereof. So I like the picnic, too, because it accommodates where I can slice it, chop it. I can use the outside. You can take the inside and outside and slice it, and the inside and outside and chop it. And believe me, my customers, you know, you got to have a lot of buttons on the cash register. So, and then we put the sauce on it after we either put it on a plate, put it on a bun, and we serve it with a dill pickle. So that's the method that I use.
Carolyn, will you tell us about
that?
I'm going to his house.
What kind of salt?
I like kosher salt. It's better on meat than iodine salt.
I just want to make one comment about competition cooking first. The people who cook on the circuit, whatever circuit it might be, are not allowed to use gas. They use wood or charcoal or a combination of wood and charcoal. Our people are incredibly dedicated. We are dedicated to preserving barbecue as a sport, an art form, a culinary technique. So it's a thing that I like to compare us to quilters. We're preserving a time-honored technique. At home, we've got the same 24 hours everybody else does, so we're not above grilling if we want to have dinner before 10 p.m. But being a Southern girl at one time, I grew up on a vinegar and vinegar-based basting sauce. The wood of choice for barbecuing was hickory. Since I've been in the Midwest, I've gotten much more attached to fruit woods than I was originally, mainly because I'd never been exposed to it. The meat of choice still has to be pork, almost any kind. It's just great. The things I see outside the barbecue belt are places where, particularly dining establishments, that the barbecue is drowned in sauce. When I see that, I always wonder what the pitmaster is trying to hide. I think that sauce can cover a multitude of sins, and in the truest position or sense of the word, that sauce, if you're going to use it sparingly, and it should complement the meat. At this point in my life, I like a dry rub a lot better than I like a sauce, but my preference.
Okay, that was nice. Well, I start out early in the morning also. First thing I do is light my charcoal every morning. And once it gets hot, then I normally put my hickory in. After I put my hickory in, I let it kind of like start burning a little bit. I don't do a rub. I have a marinade that I use. I marinate with all sorts of different seasonings in it. And when I run that marinade out, some things I marinate all night long. And that morning I put them on, cook them, take them off within a reasonable amount of hours, and we put the sauce on then. The key to it is, like Carolyn was just saying, you don't want to overpower your product by putting a whole lot of sauce on. We have a tomato-based sauce. It's very, very good. We just put a little bit on at a time. It speaks for itself, and that's the nature of it.
Great. Ours is very similar. It's, we slow smoke picnics over hickory wood and use a dry rub on the ribs and even on the chicken.
Well, one of the things that interests me in terms of future barbecue is what's going to happen to all these regional specialties that we've been celebrating and denigrating over the weekend. Van, you're trying to get back into the franchise business that your father was. Carolyn, you're trying to get barbecue competitions all around the country. So far, Frank, you're not talking about franchising, but you do have to figure out how to please those folks in Memphis, even though more and more of them may not have been born in Memphis than they have on the table. Of course, Rick, you're a businessman, so I assume another operation is not out of the question if all goes well with this one. I'm wondering whether or not regional specificity in barbecue can survive when we're moving more and more to national culture or national organizations or trying to broaden the appeal of the product. Why don't we start at the other end this time,
Rick? Well, I mean, it's something that we're a 40-unit chain, and what we're facing is that when you go into, it's one thing to be in Tennessee where everybody knows barbecue, but when you're going into an Akron, Ohio, you have to have a broader appeal, and I think that what we're looking at is broadening our menu some so that you can get a lot of different flavors of the Southern cooking so that, for example, on our table, we don't drown our barbecue in sauce, but we put four sauces on the table. We put a Kansas City sauce and a vinegar sauce and a tomato-based sauce and a hot sauce so that, you know, there's a little bit more appeal there, a little bit wider, and the customer can decide what they, you know, what they want.
That's a question here.
Well, in your particular case, I'll give you an example. There's a neighborhood place in Memphis that I always liked, the Hawkins Grill, where J.C. Carter was cooking. And it seems to me that nobody outside of the neighborhood knew that. But as the city's growing, as more and more people from different parts of the city, different parts of the country, they come into your restaurant, how do you maintain your stock, but also manage to appeal to an ever-growing population of customers?
Well, I pretty much just kind of stick with my original and just traditional way of cooking. I haven't changed anything for to make it different for anybody. I think barbecue is something that you learn, you try to keep it the same, you stick to the right things to make it be around for a long time. I mean, if you use other products, other cookers that changes the flavor of barbecue, then sometimes you kind of get off a little bit.
From the competition circuit end, for instance, we have the Jack Daniel's World Championship Barbecue Contest next weekend in Lynchburg, Tennessee at the Jack Daniel's Distillery. These winners are people who have won state championships and major competitions. A major competition is 50 teams or more. State championship is as defined by that state's government or that state's governor. They will call and say, what should I do to change my recipe so that the judges there will like the product better? What are they looking for? my advice is the same as Frank says, dance with those that bring you. It's, if you've got something that's won you a competition, you might as well stick with it because the judges are from all over the country. So it's like saying an Alabama team winning at Kansas City is entirely possible. A Kansas City team winning in North Carolina, a Washington team winning in Florida. All those things have happened. So I think that people are getting sophisticated enough in their cooking techniques that they're able to cook just great, plain, old, good barbecue. From a restaurant standpoint, it was just as an observation of eating all over the country, there are more and more places that are featuring a Memphis-style pulled pork sandwich, say a Texas brisket sandwich, hot links from Texas. So you are seeing the regional styles featured at different restaurants all over the place now. So you're getting a great blend, each one different. But it makes the eating experience a lot more fun.
Well, I've served a lot of, you know, mine's a typical place. You get a lot of cross culture, you get a lot of travelers. And I love it when you get, you know, people from North Carolina or wherever, and they, you know, they're going to eat it, and then you're going to ask them how they like it. And, you know, they'll tell you, oh, yeah, that's good, I like that. But you know they really like it because they're wearing some on their shirt. You know, you got to get a little on your shirt, you get a little on your mouth. But they can't tell the other guy from North Carolina that they like it. It reminds me of something somebody told me recently about what's the difference between a Catholic and a Baptist. Catholics will speak to each other at a liquor store. So it's kind of the same thing. You know, he can't tell the other guy from North Carolina that he liked it, but if he's traveling by himself, you know, you might hear a little bit more about it. The biggest challenge I face is the guy with the cowboy hat with the belt buckle and boots, and he just will not get pork. You let him go ahead and get chicken or whatever he wants, and then you walk over to the table and just slip him a little barbecue pork and then just kind of, you know, fade away. And then as he leaves, you'll notice he's wearing some on his shirt. So, but I think that, regionally speaking, I think, you know, I like to comment about even the bad stuff's good. And I found that when they're from other parts of the country, they really do like it. They just express it differently.
Well, we do have some time constraints, but I'd like to move to questions from the audience a bit sooner than we might otherwise have. I was expecting you to have some questions. I see we got the first one already. Mr. Apple.
Thanks, Lois. I'd like to hear from each of you an expression whether you are basically optimistic or basically pessimistic about the survival of barbecue as a regional traditional food.
Question for each of our panelists is, tell us whether or not you're basically optimistic or pessimistic about the survival of traditional barbecue as a regional food.
I'll go first. I think it is going to survive very well. I think you're seeing more interest in barbecue as a legitimate food group than we have ever seen before. I'm a member of IACP. They don't really like to, or they didn't in the past, like to recognize barbecue very much there until we just sort of kept harping at them, and we're really tolerated pretty well now, mainly because we raised a lot of money for the Julia Child Foundation there. But I think that people are, we have a Jewish member in the Barbecue Society who described it very well. He said, we have been through all those regional foods or all those other cuisines, and now we're coming back to those roots, and those roots happen to be barbecue. Barbecue is the only truly American cuisine.
Yes, and I think barbecue will survive also. It's a work of art, and I think it'll be around here for a long, long time.
You've got to be optimistic. There's great food. I'm gonna eat it till I die.
15 years younger than you should.
No. I think it survived too. When people get real barbecue for the first time, you can tell, you know, there's kind of a dumbing down of the taste bud, but when people get real and get good barbecue, you can tell that, you know, they're going to tell somebody and it's going to survive. The biggest challenge, perhaps, is having authentic barbecue and keeping it around is the enemy out there that I have to face in the public health department. But other than dealing with all their temperature issues and their, you know, it's hard to keep the product real and authentic and have that little guy coming around that thermometer, you know, every 30, 40 days. You have to learn to work with that. So. That's the only threat I see is the health department.
Oh, sure, it exists. All over the place.
The best thing to do is read the label. It's usually in descending order, you know, and so a lot of times you just read the label. When it's, you know, cooked pork and tomato sauce, or, you know, I mean, the truth in labeling can reveal a lot.
Are you talking about prefix supplies provided to restaurants to sell barbecue?
Yeah.
I'm dealing with that now. I'm doing a USDA facility, and we're packing and doing some barbecue for some concession people. And mine is going to be authentic, and you'll be able to tell by the label, because I think the FDA says it has to be direct fire to be called barbecue, as opposed to, you know, smoked or stewed or something. So if you'll get on my website in 3 weeks, maybe perhaps I can send you some for your case, and you can let me know. But the biggest challenge has been developing a pit that the USDA would let me have, you know, and because you've got these cleanliness standards that you have to, this pre-operation inspection thing. And so we've developed a pit through the help of a company in Mesquite, Texas, where we're able to cook it the real way, you know, direct fire, turn it and do all that, yet we're able to disassemble the thing and get it to the standards that they want it to be, so that you can have their blessing and their little establishment label on there. So, read the label.
Jack? This is a related question, but can you all talk a little bit about the pig? You know, if you go to Spain or something, every village you go to, the four tasteful differences, they'll raise their pigs on acorns here, something else there. But I think we've all realized that pigs are mass produced largely in North Carolina now. Pork chop in New Haven, San Diego, is largely the same thing. So all the rubs seem regional, all the technique and wood seem regional, but I'm worried about the pig.
Somebody can answer that.
Go for it.
Well, it's a far different animal than my dad. He's kind of concerned about the consistency of the pork, the supply of the pork, the consistency of that. And concerned about the pig, and I am too, because it's by far a leaner animal than we've ever dealt with. You know, they don't use lard, don't need lard. That could be unfortunate too, but they've bred a lot of that lard out of these pigs. The thing I've noticed lately is the USDA or FDA, whoever controls that, the pigs are larger than they used to be, but they're not fat. You know, they're just like a mean-weighted hog, I think, now is like 230-something pounds, where they used to be about 190, 215. So that's why I don't cook a shoulder, because, I mean, it's a monster. You know, it's just a monster thing. When my dad cooked them, they were 10 and 12 and down. You know, they're 18 and 20 now. And so I'm concerned about that, too. And I have old customers that come in and say, which you hate that, but they give you that. Boy, this don't taste like what your daddy cooked, you know. Well, you know, that cuts to the bone, but I have to tell them I'm not cooking the same animal, and so.
Is there any effort to try to buy a pig locally rather than buy it from a big farm?
I know in USDA, with your HACCP plan, I know positively you cannot do that. They have to have a HACCP certification, you know, also, but from what I understand, all of them are contract grown, and you can't take, we used to have a company in my little town called Polar Locker, and you could load them up in the back of the truck and slaughter them, and I don't think there are very many Polar Lockers left.
A 2 or 3 pound container, and if you look real closely at that product, it'll say whatever the name of the barbecue company is, and it'll have barbecue in the name of the company. It'll say that it's pork or beef in barbecue sauce, but it will not say on the label that it's barbecue. It's not barbecue beef, it's not barbecue pork, it's not barbecue ribs, whatever it is. These are attempts to bastardize what real barbecue is. They're attempts at making an awful lot of money by cooking the product very quickly, steam, oil, roast, whatever it is. None of them are cooked using smoke or plain hardwoods. There is a USDA definition that requires that true barbecue, in order for it to be shipped interstate, and it's a federal law, has to be cooked in a certain way, and that's using hardwoods or smoke generated from hardwoods. It's a long description. It even goes into the amount of shrinkage that's necessary in terms of the weight of that particular piece of food. What I'm concerned about, I have a small barbecue joint in San Francisco, and as we all know, San Francisco doesn't have a tremendous barbecue tradition. Unless you consider tofu and bean sprouts barbecue. What I'm concerned about in my area is the bastardization of barbecue. Everything that I see is barbecue. And Carol talks about barbecue being more popular now than it's ever been. I'm concerned because I think that the word barbecue, we hear it more and more and more, but I don't think that that actually refers to true barbecue. I think there's less and less real barbecue than there ever was before. I know in San Francisco we have Thai barbecue, we have Mongolian barbecue, we have Korean barbecue, we have backyard barbecue. Everything is barbecue. But when everything is barbecue, then really nothing is barbecue. And I'm distraught because I'm thinking that perhaps we're going to lose this truly authentic regional cuisine to the people who want to make enormous amounts of profit off of something that really is basically not profitable. I tell people all the time, my customers come in, you know, they want to know what's going on, and I say, well, here I've got a pork butt here that takes me 15 hours to cook. I've got a bottle of red sauce here that I make and I'm very proud of, but you know it takes me 15 minutes to make 5 gallons of red sauce. So I think on the one hand, I'm concerned about the onslaught of sauce. Of sauce as barbecue, which is not to say that sauce doesn't belong on barbecue, it does belong on barbecue, but it ain't barbecue. Okay.
had a question from Mary Berman, and back to you.
Okay. I more so didn't have a question, but I wanted to elaborate with what you said about catering. And also, I do agree with you. And what is going on, you have products now where you have battery pack ribs and different things in the grocery store, but you have to look at it from a market point of view. With these products in the stores now, say you live in the South where you have Memphis, and you have the Midwest, Kansas City, and you have barbecue in South Carolina. But once you get outside of those states, a lot of people really don't know about barbecue. So by these products going to the store, it increases the awareness of barbecue itself. It's making barbecue more marketable. And what you have now is people are wanting to know about Memphis barbecue. They're wanting to know about Kansas City barbecue and why does South Carolina, why do they barbecue a different way and why is the mustard sauce and why do you have a tomato-based sauce? So even though I don't care for these products, I want to say that it's not my favorite thing when you go to the grocery store and see that. It helps your business because more people are wanting to eat barbecue. And when they come to the South, the first thing they say to us is, I want a full pork sandwich. When I go to Texas, I want a beef sandwich. And it's because they have marketed barbecue across the country now as something that they haven't had. Once you get outside the South and the Midwest, you can't find barbecue places that could fit barbecue when you do it the way we do it. So I agree with you, but it also helps your business to grow. Because when they come to the South, they look for you. Now you have magazines calling you and they want to write about how you do your business, how you barbecue, and maybe that's a good way of educating people so they understand that the things in the grocery store are not real barbecue, but this is the foundation. So maybe we need to find a way of better educating people on what they're selling.
Okay. Our final question.
A lot has been said about the sauce and the fire and everything, but not as much has been said or addressed about the fresh quality of the meat involved and how you select that from your supplier, whether it be if you go to a supermarket or you go to the wholesaler that comes into your shop, because the quality control of the meat is what keeps the customer. Anybody address if you go, how you do that?
Well, I use Boston Butts, and of course, I want my Boston Butts to come in fresh every day. I mean, when I get them, I want them coming. The only thing that I might get that's frozen is ribs, and check the dates on them.
Now, he's right, there's a kill date on the box. If it's frozen, I send it back. If it's frozen, you gotta know when did it freeze, has it thawed out any? Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a line, there's a timeline there. So I agree with Frank 100%. If it's not fresh, I mean, if you don't start out with something really good, and especially with barbecue, that hot fire, if it's been frozen, that takes a lot of moisture out of it anyway. And you know, you're going to cook it on this temperature for all this time, and if it's been frozen, it in the end, it's just not going to have that moistness it's supposed to have, but. There are good suppliers, you know. I've got a really good supplier that watches out and won't have any problems because, you know, they want the business. And so on that end of the supply, I mean, I don't see any problems.
We've had a couple of questions about the quality of meat. I want to dovetail on those and ask one more. A lot of pork producers now, meat producers in general now, for sanitary are not giving the animal a whole lot of chemicals, if they're not doing some of the things that the meat manufacturers have been accused of in books like Fast Food Nation and recent stuff in the Cover Nation magazine. I wonder whether any of you have been approached by any of these sort of routine suppliers, or if you've considered trying to go through those kinds of suppliers rather than the folks in North Carolina who are producing pork for damn everybody.
What I gotta have is a good, consistent supply, and what I call a jobber that brings it in off a tractor trailer, throws it on a bobtail, and goes around all the restaurants. I mean, you got it when you order, you know, 80 cases of ribs. I mean, you don't need 30, and so you have to stay with somebody that you know that will meet the demand you're after, because you know. A lot of times, years ago, honestly, before there was this contract growing, we ordered from a company named Ziegler. And mother would really want 60, so she'd order 80 because they always shorted the order. Well, I don't find that now. The few that are out there, the jobbers, there are very few, are real consistent with it. And the only problem I see is, and I don't know if anybody else has this experience, but they trimming ribs. I mean, sometimes they'll want to make a little extra, and they'll give you what I call a shiner, where they'll cut the backside down real low. And it's just, that's the fight that I have, is just with trimming of ribs.
Yeah, I understand.
You know, I'm talking about shiner, yeah.
One more.
Yeah, one more, and that's it.
You choose.
Oh, okay. I saw the motto and I saw the V. I'm flipping a coin. Two more. Oh, Lord. All right. Heads of the beam, tails of motto. Tails of motto.
Well, to your point, Lois, about this sort of new kind of, well, it's not new, it's old. The old way of producing without the factory farming and the hormones and the antibiotics, I think that your reaction value is very typical, and we being in the business as well, it's a fledgling thing now to get back to something that's natural, back to something that makes sense. You can parallel it to what's going on in the organic movement in agriculture. It's hard for them, it's hard for us, it's hard for everybody. You've got to be concerned about consistency of supply, you've got to be concerned about price. Barbecue is not a big margin business, you know what I mean? The perceived value of it is not that high that you can charge $35 for a rack of ribs, you know? So we are all behind that effort in our hearts, and we hope that it can become mainstream. But it's a struggle right now for everybody to be able to do that and get the supply and be economically viable, you know. So I don't know. I think people on the non-professional level can help by supporting that and asking for it in grocery stores and supermarkets, and raising awareness about how the majority of pork in our country is produced and what it's doing to our lives and our land.
Go ahead, Mr.
Yeah, actually, Michael and I are on the same wavelength there. The answer always to your question is, you know, and for someone like Van, if you could find a pork producer who isn't in part destroying the land that they are raising their pigs on, but you would have to charge, you know, if it cost you 20% more, you know, could you in fact pass that on to your customer without a rebellion on the part of your customers? Because really the issue is, for someone like Michael at the Union Square Cafe or even at Blue Smoke, it's easier for them to buy, say, Nine Ranch pork, which is essentially a place where they have farms all over the country raising pigs according to their specifications. And, you know, it's one thing for him to pass it on to Blue Smoke Cafe, who spoke, another thing for Van to pass it on to his customer at the barbecue joint, and that's really where the rubber meets the road, I assume, someone like you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is they re-engineered the pig, completely changed the physiognomy of the pig, so that within his parallel, they can move, they carry out all their bodily functions in the same place, because it's
Right. It's kind of like a lot of these people that are now growing their, you know, own produce for salads and things. I wish the barbecue industry could do that, where we could have someone that would grow animals for us that suits the end thing that we're trying to do. But it's a great point about the perception of what barbecue should cost. You know, they think it's something that should be relatively cheap, but like my mother used to say, I mean, do they know what I've gone to get what's on that plate? I mean, you got the wood issue, the shrinkage issue. I mean, I throw something up there that weighs 8 or 10 pounds, it comes off weighing 5 or 4, you know, there's huge shrinkage, and that's where you get this erosion of the profit. So that's why you come in the store and you get a 20-ounce Coke and it's $1.50. I'm trying to make a margin off that drink, or off that piece of pie, or off that fry, you know, off of other items, so that, you know, I think that was a lot of times the birth of the, you know, without offending anybody, but the birth of the smoker a lot of times, I think, was to help fight shrinkage.
Yeah,
Because when you direct fire cook that barbecue, man, you're getting a lot of shrinkage. You're just watching that water content go down that fire. And I think a lot of times, you know, that's what's hurt barbecue. But you got to cook it. You got to shrink it and charge them what you have to charge them and be creative and mark the drink up, mark the chips up, and, you know, sell them a gallon of tea for $3 that cost you 14 cents or something.